I'd like to begin this evening by pointing out one way of understanding the spiritual path. I think there's many ways of understanding it. But one way is to see that it's essentially about a relationship to experience. What we're trying to do is we're trying to become aware of how our minds relate to momentary experience. And then provide, really, a kind of a new relationship to experience, one that leads to liberation. So, for example, within our meditation, we start to become aware of just simply how the mind is relating to the breath. And then providing the conditions to cultivate this new relationship, one of really mainly of being aware of the breath, of being present with it, with having less reactivity. Or it could be to a sound, or to an emotion, or to a sensation. To notice how the mind's relating to it, and we can be aware of how the mind reacts, but also having more of this relationship of being present with it. And if you think about it, it's not only in meditation that we're cultivating this different relationship, or we're becoming curious about our relationship to experience, but it's also within the ethical realm, how we relate to others. You know, there's the whole teaching around skillful speech. Or it could be in terms of livelihood or action. So, again, really about our relationship to experience. And tonight, what I'd like to do is just to offer you some reflections on another arena of our lives, a rather tricky one, and that's our relationship to money. How do you relate to money? What's your relationship to money? And I guess I just want to point out, hopefully the obvious, if you imagine how cool would it be if you could really change your relationship to money? One where there would be this liberating quality there. To really skillfully utilize money, because it really is part of the culture and society that we live in, but not having it dictate our lives, especially in terms of worries and fantasies. Wouldn't that be cool? To have more freedom around this tricky subject? And it is. It's really complex. For example, I just went out to eat with a whole bunch of Sangha folk at Annapurna, and we were discussing a little bit this topic. And what I started to realize is really how complex it is in terms of our own lives, in terms of just socially how we interact with others and how we navigate the issue of money, and also personally how we relate to it. And as a way of beginning, I want to point out a few things about this realm of money. First of all, I want to emphasize that money, which also ties into livelihood, right? Livelihood, which is one of the factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, which again is a fundamental teaching of the Buddha. It's an essential and integral part of this path. And I'd like to point out what I try to remind myself of is that there's nothing within our experience that lies outside of our spiritual path. So that includes money. You might notice, like I do, when you get involved in a spiritual path, there are things that we include in our spiritual path, and then habitually there's things that we exclude. And I find a lot of times, you know, this is what I was noticing in my life, that's why I like to give this talk, is I like to notice, what am I excluding from my spiritual path? And I noticed both in my own life and other people's lives, money is one of those things. But it is. It's a part of the spiritual path. And one of the things I found fascinating is reading the early discourses of the Buddha, from the Pali Canon, the Pali being the early scriptural language of Buddhism. The Buddha actually spoke often about money and wealth and one's relationship to it. He was actually not excluding it at all. It was something that he wanted to speak about, especially to lay practitioners. And I guess I want to point out also that, which I was pointing out before, that money can be a challenging and tricky thing to talk about. I think we often, and you might notice this, that we often feel uncomfortable speaking about money. Our relationship to money, how much we make, how much we don't make. There was a psychotherapist, actually quite well known by the name of Irvin Yalom. He was known for his research and his work mostly around group psychotherapy. And he pointed out an interesting or a fascinating thing in his group therapy. He noticed that people were willing to divulge and to share some of the most intimate and most revealing things about their lives. Yet when it came to money, people were unwilling to talk about that. It's just fascinating. He said it was probably the most uncomfortable subject that he saw within group psychotherapy, and I think in individual psychotherapy as well. It's a tricky thing to talk about. I saw a study, a quite interesting study, where they noticed that people were comfortable and willing to speak about money, especially in terms of their own finances, if the individual had a sense that everyone in the group that they were speaking to, if they had the guess that they were making more than them. So we might feel comfortable talking about our financial situation if we have a sense that we might be making less than other people. Again, it's dictating in a sense of what we feel comfortable with or uncomfortable with in terms of speaking about money. It can be tricky to navigate it. And I guess I want to also acknowledge that it's just challenging, because I think just in this room right now, there's probably a whole spectrum of income levels just sitting in here right now. And probably just in this room right now, there's probably a whole range of possible challenges and difficulties around money. And all of us, all of you probably have different histories around money and ways that you were brought up, or different conditionings around how you view money. So I want to acknowledge the huge range that's probably just in here right now. And I think the other tricky thing is that many of us value this thing called equality. Yet we live in a world of actually vast economic inequality, even possibly in this room. And so again, that can lend to the challenge around this issue. But I think even with that wide range that might, you know, that exists in this room, I think all of us, I'm sure all of you can notice what an important thing it is to explore our relationship to money, because it's such a sticky thing. I mean, and it's fascinating when you think about it. You know, what's money? It's really quite wild. It really is just an abstraction. I mean, especially now in the world of ours, you know, most of the time it's simply a construct. It's a construct that gets represented simply by numbers on a computer screen. That's all it is. It's actually not even a dollar bill or a check, possibly not even a credit card, but a number that changes on a computer screen. That's what it is. And yet, have you noticed the huge stories that the mind creates, the obsessive stories — that's the important word here — the obsessive stories that get created around this abstraction? So much misery around numbers on a computer screen. And yet I also want to point out, it's an integral part of the world that you live in. We can't just ignore those numbers. We have to figure out a way to skillfully navigate it. So it might be abstract and it might be a construct, but how do we navigate that world? I feel it really leads to this essential question: how do you cultivate a liberating relationship to money? How do you cultivate that? And I feel this is important for your spiritual path. If this path is about freedom, here's a place where often we can find a lot of suffering. How can you begin to examine your relationship to money and become curious about it, and to actually make it a part of your spiritual path? And I, once again, I want to emphasize this, that to begin with, there is nothing inherently evil about money from the Buddhist perspective. There's nothing inherently unwholesome about it. Rather, it all depends about how you relate to it. It's in the relationship that determines if it's skillful or unskillful, or wholesome or unwholesome. I liken it to thinking, the activity of thinking. So often I find many meditators, I think all of you have probably experienced this at some point, I know I have, that at some point in our meditation practice, thinking becomes the enemy. But actually, thinking is not the enemy on the spiritual path. It's not the enemy in meditation. It's how the mind is relating to it. Is there a lot of liking or not liking? Is there ability to see it for what it is? How does your mind relate to thinking? That's what we're trying to become curious about. And in the same way, anger is not the problem. Or sadness is not the problem. Or frustration is not the problem. Or loneliness. It's how you relate to it. You know, more broadly speaking, as the Buddha said, really what he was emphasizing, it's not what we experience, but how we relate to that experience. And if you reflect upon it right now, you might notice that from money and wealth, there can actually be wonderful things that arise out of money, out of wealth, when it's skillfully related to, when it's skillfully utilized. For example, in the Buddha's time, there was one of the Buddha's great benefactors was a man by the name of Anathapindika. And he was an extremely wealthy supporter of the Buddha, and he purchased a chunk of land called Jetta's Grove from Prince Jetta. And he paid a heavy price for it, 1.8 million pieces of gold. What he did is he spread out on the entire area a piece of gold so it covered the entire park in order to purchase it from Prince Jetta, because the prince did not want to sell it. So Anathapindika says, I will cover the entire park with money because I feel like it's so valuable to support the monastics. That was a wholesome act. It was an act that the Buddha commended, a great act of generosity, and it came out of Anathapindika's wealth, a skillful utilization of money. And throughout the history of Buddhism, there have been many benefactors that have allowed this practice to unfold and grow. Another example. Some of you might know this, but the independence movement in India that was spearheaded by Mahatma Gandhi, a man who lived a very simple life. That independence movement was heavily funded by a man by the name of Jamalal Bajaj, and he actually was the owner of the Bajaj Corporation, which was a huge Indian corporation that had a lot of wealth behind it. And it was the wealth from this corporation that allowed Mahatma Gandhi to spear the independence movement. It allowed him to, in some ways, live a simple life and to inspire so many people in India. It was wealth that was put to, a very important end, the independence of India. So again, beautiful things can be brought into the world through the skillful use of money. And I want to point out, of course, the opposite. It's amazing the kind of harm that has been committed in the pursuit of wealth and money. I mean, just think about it. Right? There are many examples where actually people will kill for money. I invite you to reflect on just the history of this land that we're on right now. Like the Americas. Beginning in 1492, the Spaniards and Europeans were coming over, and a great amount of harm was committed in the Americas, really for the pursuit of gold and silver. And the acquisition of gold and silver that was acquired in the Americas, of course, completely transformed the economies in Europe. But it was the result of great harm to the native populations here. Or even more recently, for example, in the Democratic Republic of Congo. short, it's called the DRC. And the most recent conflict there, a lot of it was around wealth. So the conflict in the DRC, in case you don't know, it's been the deadliest conflict, the deadliest war since World War II. An estimated 5.4 million people were killed in the DRC. And if you really look at the dynamic of that war, it was really quite unique because a lot of it was simply around plundering the country, about acquiring its wealth, a lot of it in its natural resources. So many different factions were involved in this war. So millions of people killed as a result of greed around money and wealth. I mean, even today in the DRC, it's said that two-thirds of the money secretly leaves the DRC untaxed. It's a country that is still being plundered today. So great harm around this acquisition of wealth. So with that wide range, again, I want to emphasize, it's not, money's not the problem. It's how we relate to it. It's how we utilize it. It's the relationship that's there. Again, how do you skillfully relate to money? A couple of months ago, a friend of mine came through Flagstaff. He was doing actually a benefit for the DRC, for many people in the DRC, to help them gain money to learn a trauma intervention that he knows and I know. And I loved his philosophy about life, and I think it speaks to a skillful relationship to money. He said, I made a deal with the universe. As long as my needs are met, I will help out wherever people ask me to. As long as my needs are met, I'll help out. I feel like that's, for me, a really inspiring relationship to money. Money being tied with meeting our needs. And placing what's important to them in the right place. Really a value of helping others. Sometimes he also adds, once my needs are not being met, I'm renegotiating the deal. But that's an important aspect, meeting one's needs and one's needs of one's family or those that one is responsible for. That's one way that I hope, just to put in your mind, hopefully I'll spend a little time reflecting on, is money in terms of meeting our needs and making sure that's not where we're placing all our happiness, is within money, but a way of supporting what's valuable to us. And then another story, which I was quite surprised about. I was leading a discussion with the Dharma group about our relationship to money. And we were speaking about various relationships. And one of the women in the group was speaking about how she was really torn. She was at this point in her life where she was thinking of retiring. And she and her partner were at a place, she said, that both of them had enough money that it would have been easy for her to retire right then. They had enough money, both her and her partner had saved enough money that she could retire at this age. And she was saying to the group, I'm torn. I don't know if I should really retire. I don't know what's really valuable to me. And so I was thinking, well, you know, with all the suggestions that we're giving her in the group and our ideas, she's going to want to live a more simple life and retire, you know, to not have this value around money that we always have. And I remember speaking to her a few days after our discussion, and she said the most interesting thing. She said, that discussion group was so helpful because it helped me clarify that I want to continue to work. And the reason I want to continue to work is so that I have extra money to give to people that are so important in my life, that I've enjoyed supporting in my life. And it's more important for me to do a job I enjoy and have extra money in order to spend it on these things I value. Which I thought was so skillful, which is a different relationship to money. Yes, acquiring money, but I think for a really wholesome cause. To have more of an ability to practice generosity. But still, I feel a skillful relationship. And here, money in terms of maybe not so much needs, but in terms of what she was valuing. I want to point a few things out about both of these examples. And one, you might see that in both of them, it's their contentment or their happiness or what they're valuing in both of these stories is not solely dependent upon how much money they have. It might be around how they utilize it, but not money in and of itself. Because you might notice, so often our minds can begin to get lost in this belief that wealth equals happiness. I think often, I don't think this is always what underlies resentment around people that are wealthy, but sometimes it can, is that sometimes the mind or our minds can resent wealthy people because there's still a belief that wealth equals happiness, and so that they have more opportunity for happiness. I think it's more complex than that, but that might be a small piece to it. And I want to acknowledge that it's really true. When they've done studies, people's lives get easier and they end up being more content when they move out of a low income bracket into a middle, you know, into basically what would be kind of middle of the road, middle income. So I really want to point that out. That's very important. Money can be very helpful in terms of well-being and contentment up to a certain stage. But basically, after a middle-of-the-road, middle-class income, happiness and contentment, they say, does not increase. Again, that's important to know. I mean, it might have social ramifications if we were really to reflect on that. So I want to acknowledge that as I'm speaking about money. So some of the things I say might sound like they're going against that. So I want to really make sure that we know that fact. But I invite you to really ask, do you base your happiness on the amount of money that you have? And to be honest with yourself, do you notice how your mind might slip into that? A lot of times, you know, you might have this thought that you don't end up in that realm, but if you really look at the thought patterns, you might notice a different pattern. Sometimes the way I see it is this quality of thinking of what if? What if this happens? Am I going to have enough money? What if that happens? Have you ever noticed the what ifs? A lot of times it's connected with issues or concerns around money. A lot of times with the what ifs, there can be an underlying assumption that if only, which is the only one, is the other phrase, by mind saying what if or if only a lot of time what underlies that is if only I had some more money or what if I had this much money then I'd be secure. There is underlying that if there was a certain amount of money then I would be happy, then I would be content, then there would be stability and safety in my life. Have you noticed this thought process around money? Or am I the only one? So it's important to notice how we can, what's underlying that is that's where our happiness lies. That belief of that. And the Buddha was very clear about not placing our happiness in wealth or money. For example, he was back in his kind of hometown province, Kapalavatthu. And he was speaking to the Sakyan clan, the clan that he had come from. And the question arose, I think he was asking the practitioners, he was saying, so have you been following or have you been practicing on the Uposatha days? So simply put, I don't want to get too much into it, but an Uposatha day is, you'd say, a day that's put aside where we reflect on and we renew our commitment to this path. And their answer was, well, sometimes yeah, sometimes no. Sometimes we practice on Uposatha days, other days, And the Buddha's comment was quite fascinating. He started, it sounded like he was off on a tangent. So when I first started reading it, I was thinking, it's like he's kind of missing the point, the Buddha. What is he going on about this other topic about? And he started talking about how people of great wealth and how capable people are who can acquire great wealth. And he asked the practitioners there, he said, do you think someone with a vast amount of wealth Do you think that that person, their lives, leads to a deep sense of bliss and contentment? And luckily, the Sakyan practitioners were wise. They said, "No, Venerable Sir, of course not. What wealth brings is only inconstant. It's unreliable. No deep sense of bliss or happiness could come from such a thing." And of course, he says, just so, practitioners. But if a practitioner were to practice for 10 years, not even 10 years, but 9 years, and it keeps on going, not even 9 years, but 5 years, or 1 year, or if a practitioner were not only to only practice for 2 weeks, not even 2 weeks, 1 week, if a practitioner were only to practice for a night and a day, that would lead to a deeper sense of bliss and contentment than chasing after wealth. Quite a striking statement. Can you remember what's really going to lead to contentment and happiness? And I feel, that's what I feel so grateful about this spiritual path, this spiritual practice, is the reminder of where my contentment and my deep sense of freedom really, really comes from. A while back, I have a confession. I had about a week that life got crazy and I wasn't sitting. And my mind was forgetting about the value of being present. And when I got back to the cushion, it was so striking. Actually, I was really grateful that I had that week. Because when I sat down, the feeling sense was, wow, what a relief to just have this reminder that all the things I was getting lost in that week, they're not going to bring my deep happiness and contentment. But this practice of being present, even when it's unpleasant, can lead me to a place where there's more happiness, more contentment, more liberation. And just from sitting, that reminder. Because you might notice, like my mind did during that week, of how easy it is to get seduced and caught by these beliefs that creep into our mind that our happiness and contentment can lie in these unreliable places like money. And what a cool thing that we have, this reminder through community and through practice of a different kind of freedom. Because in some ways that's what this path is about, we gradually do find ease and stability, maybe an impermanent ease and stability, but in a more skillful place. In really skillful states of mind that eventually lead to a deeper liberation. A liberation that has a quality of being with this impermanent, groundless quality of our moment-to-moment experience. And I want to point out another thing about the meditation practice. One of the things that we begin to see through meditation, which I'm sure has been spoken about here, is we begin to see the nature of reality. And one of the ways that's spoken about in the early discourses is we begin to see these three characteristics of moment-to-moment experience: that it's impermanent, that it's unreliable, and that it's not me. And in some ways, this is what we need to come to see about money, about wealth. It is impermanent. It's definitely unreliable, and it's not about me. And the last one is very important because there's so much identity that's wrapped around wealth and money, the way we see ourselves. That's why it's so difficult to speak about. Because we think that the amount of money that we have or lack thereof is a reflection of me. And there's so much suffering that arises around that. Or we begin to see other people that way, that how much money a person has is a reflection of who they are. And it really limits our ability to connect with them. I just want to caveat that I want to say now before I forget. So I have to back up a little bit. As I was speaking about this quality of mind of these what-if thoughts or this if-only thoughts. What if this were to happen? Then my life would be ruined if I don't have enough money. If only I had this much money, then things would be going well. I want to point out, of course we need to plan. Of course we need to think about money. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be thinking about the future and being clear about it. But that's different than the obsessive quality that the mind can get into, that fear-driven quality. Does that difference make sense? It has a different feeling sense in the body of being clear about it and obsessing about it in a way that's unhelpful. And really, to meet one's needs skillfully, it really demands, it's going to demand a clear relationship to this abstract thing that we call money. A little bit more about a skillful relationship to money, especially in terms of needs. Another story from the early canon. One afternoon, the Buddha was hanging out, and it was probably in Jetta's Grove, this place that Anattapindika had purchased for the monastics in a province called Savatthi. And it was the afternoon, and a supporter of the Buddha came by, King Pasenadi. And the Buddha basically said, of course I'm paraphrasing, "What you been up to? What have you been doing today?" And King Pasenadi said to the Buddha, "Well, you're never going to believe what I was just beginning to have to deal with. There was a man in Savatthi who was extremely wealthy, and you're never going to believe it, Venerable One. He lived such a miserly life. He ate the worst of food and took very poor care of himself. And all he did was hoard that money." And the Buddha said, "Yes, what a tragedy. Somebody of great wealth not supporting things that lead," and this is very interesting, the language he used, "things that lead to his own pleasure and satisfaction. Not using that money to support his family's pleasure and satisfaction. To his community's pleasure and satisfaction. What a tragedy indeed." I feel like this is important because many times we feel like in the spiritual life we should be living a miserly or oversimplistic life. This is not actually the teaching of the Buddha. What he really recommended was to live within one's means. So someone with great wealth would be spending it actually in a way to help oneself and others. And then one with limited means would be still living within one's means in a simple way. Right? It's how you relate to money, not how much or how little. So this is important. Not getting lost in stinginess, which really is a form of greed or a form of aversion. And also not getting lost in reckless spending. I feel like it's important to really see this and see the dynamic of the mind around one's needs. Another story about this that I've seen about my own mind. Last week, my wife quit her job. I think it was a great thing that she did. I think she was questioning her happiness and where it leads. We have no idea what's next. And for me, I love the fact that my wife was working. She's been a great benefactor. It makes this life easier. So as I was trying to be as supportive of as I could be, and I really have been, that is such a cool thing that your contentment comes first. Let's go that way. Of course, I noticed my mind getting lost in the what if. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen now? Well, if only, If only she were to win $1 million, maybe then. Which, of course, is foolishness. And I could notice my mind getting lost in all of these stories and really seeing that nothing was coming of that. And actually, there was actually nothing real about it. And what was so helpful was to sink into this moment. Wow. This moment's enough. And it was so important for me to pull back from that in order to gain clarity about what's next for us. We're really just fine right now. And that's so important to remember. Of course, we might have to think about things, but that's a reality, an important reality. And it leads into, I think, another thing to remember within this practice. One story about that. About this, there is. Do you all know who Joseph Heller was, the author? Mm-hmm. Wrote this book, Catch-22, and I think a few other books. Supposedly, the way the story goes, he was at a party on Martha's Vineyard, and his friend came up to him and said, "Hey, Joe, you see that hedge fund manager over there?" And Joe said, "Yeah." And his friend said, "He made more money today than you have in your entire life." And Joseph Heller said to his friend, he said, "Yeah, but there's one thing I have that he doesn't have." And his friend said, "What's that?" And Joseph said, "Enough." There's a lot of truth to that, right? Can you see that you have enough right now in this moment as we're sitting here? Can you actually take that in? Because can you notice if you can get a feeling of that right now, how it cuts through the stories? And again, I'm saying there's, of course, there's times where we need to plan things and things like that, but the planning and the fear can be obsessive. But right now is enough. Because money, a lot of times, gives us a different message when we get lost in it. Somebody asked John D. Rockefeller how much money is enough money. And he said, "Just a little bit more." Have you noticed that? I think they did a, again, this is one of these NPR tidbits that I should look up, but it was really fascinating. This was years ago, where they actually interviewed people at all different income levels and asked them, how much money is enough money? And basically, that's what people said. Take people at lower income, which actually there's a real reality too. If you're at a low income level, being in middle class really does help. So again, I want to acknowledge that. But everybody said, you know what? If our family just made a little bit more, then we'd be okay. Mm-hmm. And that was at every single income bracket. Mm-hmm. Or just a little bit more. Mm-hmm. You might notice your mind do that. Can you cultivate more of this quality of this is enough? I wrote one poem actually entitled Enough by David White. He says, "Enough, these few words are enough. If not these words, this breath. If not this breath, this sitting here. This opening to the life we have refused again and again until now. Until now." There's one last arena that I want to just briefly speak about, and that's how money is connected to also what you value. I find that when I get clear about what I value, it can clarify my relationship to money. And one way I feel that can be really revealing in terms of what you value is to notice what do you spend your money on. And it can be a really wonderful thing to write down and to notice what are you spending your money on. What you spend your money on and where your money goes is what you value. And I feel like this is important because we might have all these ideas of what you're valuing, but what do you really value and how you are expressing that? And of course, there is the value of taking care of oneself or one's family, spending money on food and shelter. these basic things. But it also can be an expression of what you're buying and where you're buying things. It shows what you value. One of the things that I was noticing is what I valued was things that were cheap. Is that what I really wanted to value in my life? Of course, sometimes that can be really helpful for getting by. But it can be a wonderful thing to rethink that at times. What do you really value? Is that the most important value at times? And again, I want to, again, name. Sometimes we have to do that in order to get by. So I don't want to deny that in terms of the wide range of where we are on economic levels. And so what ties into that is also this opportunity that I have, that when I spend money, it can be an expression of what I value. And it can be so simple. I would rather buy the eggs from our neighbors down the street than I do at the store. I value actually supporting them. I really do. It's actually friends that have a hard time, really hard time financially. So it feels good. So again, I invite you to notice that, not as a way of chastising yourself or feeling guilty, but really seeing it as an opportunity. And an opportunity to practice ethics, a practicing non-harming. We can harm through where we spend money or not spend money. And I want to also acknowledge it's a complex world. It's challenging. I don't want to deny that. So to see it as an opportunity rather than a place that we're just shaming ourselves. And sometimes it can be just a small turning of the mind that I feel can make such a huge difference in terms of our relationship to money, in terms of what you value. One story about this that I'd like to end with is I know a practitioner who he was living in a city that was hit extremely hard by the housing market, the crash of the housing market. And just as it was completely disintegrating in the city that he was living in, he had to move. There was no way out of it. He had to move. And so he put his house on the market, and there was one offer that was made, which was, of course, much lower than what he had put into the house. But he had to sell it. And he said it was amazing. There was just one day after he had decided to go through with it where there was just this beautiful turn of mind where he said, I can have the feeling of being ripped off, or I can see this as a real act of generosity. Here's this young woman, and for her it's going to be her first time that she can purchase a house with the help of her family and other assistance. What a beautiful thing to give to this woman. And he said it made the hugest difference to see that this could really be this act of generosity rather than a loss. And there was such freedom around that. And it really was his choice, right? It was the choice of what state of mind was he going to rest in. Really, because it didn't matter. The deal was done. Our minds can get so lost in being ripped off when there's this real opportunity. And he said that the freedom was immediate just by that small turn. So what do you value? And how is it going to arise around your relationship to money, to wealth? May we cultivate a skillful relationship to money that really leads to the liberation of all beings. Thank you.